The loss of a mother defines one's life, and with the books we talk about today, the stories are not specifically about that loss, but imprints are left and life travels on. I am Suzanne Lang with A Novel Idea. I talk with two young authors today, one of fiction, the other is nonfiction, both award winners for their work, and both of their stories have the loss of a mother that serves to push the main characters into life transitions. And those transitions are what make the stories. I seldom gush about authors, but these two books really grabbed me with the skill of their storytelling, their beautiful language, and the emotional honesty represented. In a minute, I'll talk with Kendra Attlee-Work on her first published book, Miracle Country, a memoir of a family and a landscape. Kendra grew up on the east side of the Sierra Nevada mountains in a small community above Bishop, California. Her book details her own life, but also the lives of the Paiutes who made the Owens Valley their home, and the white settlers who moved into the valley, and then William Mulholland, who engineered the draining of the water of the Owens Valley to fuel the growth of Los Angeles. The book was beautiful and painful. I was drawn to it originally because of its setting in the Eastern Sierra, a place I continue to explore and that fascinates me. And her book only served to deepen my affinities and broaden my curiosity. Later in the show, I will bring you my conversation with Shruti Swami, whose first novel, The Archer, is set in 1960s and 70s Bombay, India, whose main character pursues Kathak, an Indian form of traditional dance. Kathak is a very disciplined and precise dance, yet has an ease and a lightness and subtlety in the execution, and the structure and pacing of Shruti's prose is synchronous with the movement and storytelling embodied in the dance. So stay with us for my conversation a little later with Shruti Swami. It's a novel idea. Kendra Attlee-Work, whose parents, Robert Attlee and Jan Work, forged Kendra's last name from each of their own, and also gave her a life steeped in place and location. Our family matched the strangeness of the landscape my parents had chosen, is something Kendra tells us early on in the book. And the book is Miracle Country, a memoir of a family and landscape. It's not strictly a personal memoir, but brings in the geography and geology of the region where the Owens Valley is framed by the Sierra Nevada and the White Mountains to the east. She brings in the historic of the displacement of the native Paiutes and the taking of water to flow into the faucets of L.A., making possible its enormous growth. And she shares the expression of literary compatriots to create a picture of California that is beautiful and terrible. Of the Sierra Nevada, Mary Austin, author of The Land of Little Rain, says, "You will find it forsaken of most things but beauty and madness and death and God." Here is my conversation with Kendra Attlee-Work. Welcome. So happy to talk to you this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Your book exudes a powerful love and a powerful loss. It's marked by the beauty of your writing that matches the beauty of this desert-parched landscape that you describe, of what we call the Owens Valley on the east side of the Sierra. And in the book, you provide the native names for many of the places. And the book also reflects the troubling legacy of the people attached to this place, including your own family, and the people who decimated it to provide water for Los Angeles. So I want you to start us by talking about your family that matched the strangeness of the landscape.
I grew up in the eastern Sierra Nevada mountains of California. It's a high desert at the base of these giant towering mountains. We're on the dry side. And my parents raised me and my siblings to love the desert landscape, even though it could often be harsh. Sometimes we were evacuating for avalanche risk because we lived partway up the mountain, and sometimes we were evacuating for wildfire. And I grew up playing in the dirt and avoiding getting bit by black widow spiders and rattlesnakes. And my parents taught me and my siblings to love that place. But then when I was 16, my mom died, and suddenly that place that had been a source of all of my solace as a child, kind of all of the meaning in my small world, it became empty and it became much darker. And I left for 10 years. And so Miracle Country tells the story of that time away and how I started to see my family's story merging with the story of the landscape. The California drought arrived, and suddenly this sort of sense of loss that I had felt was very personal and had sort of harbored in private, I saw it begin to manifest across the landscape as a whole, and it became something much more shared, the sense of loss and the sense of change as California started to dry out and the climate began to become something we didn't recognize as well. And I decided to come home. And so Miracle Country tells the story of that sort of the reconciling of a family story with the story of the place that shaped that family.
And your mom and dad, I guess people might relate to them if we said, at least your mom was, I would just say she had a hippie sensibility to her. But that's not necessarily how I'd describe your dad. How would you describe them?
Oh, yeah. So, you know, she was a child of the 70s, and she played the flute and she played the mandolin, and she had moved to California. She grew up in Michigan, moved to California to be a school teacher, and lived in these tiny remote places in California teaching school. She taught in Lee Vining when she first moved here in the Eastern Sierra, which is a very tiny community. And at one point she had to cross country ski 17 miles over avalanche debris to feed the stranded class hamsters. So that was just the kind of woman that she was. But in all of their wedding pictures, she's barefoot. So she definitely had a little bit of the hippie culture in her, the original hippie culture, you could say. And my dad equally loved the outdoors. They met in the Eastern Sierra. They were both drawn to the place because of the outdoors here. And he was equally enthralled by the outdoors, but maybe a little bit less clued into subcultural goings on, I guess, since he pretty much spent all of his 20s living in my hometown, initially living in the burned out shell of a restaurant where he was out in the desert. It had burned down years before, and he was able to kind of squat in it for free. So he was living in there so that he could afford to live here. And he was pumping gas at the tiny little county airport, all because of how in love with the landscape he was. This was all before he met my mom. And then he went on to find creative ways to make a living. It's a small town. It's a mostly tourist based economy. It's hard to make a living here. It's hard to stay here. And he really wanted to be here. So he became a hot air balloon pilot and eventually a map distributor and map maker. And they just wanted to raise their family here. So they made it happen.
What I found so warming in the book, and you know, most of us, even if we spend time backpacking in the Sierra or traveling through or skiing, that's just what we're doing. We have these episodic experiences that, even if it might be for as long as a couple of weeks, isn't as complete or full of this sense of place. And many people just pass through. So you really do give us a picture of what living there brings to you. And there are specters that stay with us throughout your story, and your mom is one of them. And Mary Austin is another. I found it interesting that your mother, Jan Work, and Mary Austin, who wrote her story in The Land of Little Rain, both taught school in the Eastern Sierra. William Mulholland is a spectral character who is the one who engineered taking the water away and sending it to Los Angeles, as well as Harry Williams, whose native wisdom really radiates in the book. So let's talk about some of these figures who are integral to your understanding of this place and landscape, who we come to understand as well.
Yeah, one of the most interesting things for me in writing the book was bringing in other voices, both through research and through memory and through people that I talked with in town. And I really wanted, in kind of coming to understand my own loss and what drew me back home, even though home was the source of my most difficult memories. I live in Bishop now, I live in my hometown, and it was a difficult homecoming. But in order to understand the desire to come home and in order to understand the homesickness that I was experiencing when I was living in Southern California and in Minnesota to write this book, I really had to also understand the story of the place that went beyond my own family. And that involved bringing in other voices, including historical voices. And so the book sort of tracks sort of what's been a lifelong argument in my own mind with William Mulholland, who's the engineer of the Los Angeles Aqueduct, and Owens Valley, or Payahunadu, where I live, is the supply of a large portion of Los Angeles's water on an ongoing basis. And when I was growing up, that was a story that I didn't really know the details about, but you had sort of a sense of resentment that wasn't really grounded in anything. You were a waitress for the tourists in the restaurants, and some of them were delightful and some of them were less delightful, but you still felt like you were living in a tourist town. Your home was there for the enjoyment of people passing through, it felt like sometimes. And so I felt as if Mulholland had put that in motion and changed our economy in such a way that we're dependent on tourism and then allowed Los Angeles to grow to the size that it is. And what went from sort of a diffused sense of resentment when I was a kid, as I was researching this book, became a lot more interesting and a lot more complicated. I really dug into Mulholland's life. I attempt in the book to visit his grave in Southern California. And I really just contend with his history. And at the same time, I use that as a way to think about my own role in history and where I might be falling short of seeing outside of the expectations of the dominant culture. So I try not to let myself off the hook, even when I'm sort of scrutinizing historical figures like William Mulholland.
You know, you do bring up attributes of things he said, and you try to puzzle through, well, what was his ongoing motivation? Is it greed or is it good? And does that matter? I'm not sure when we see the outcomes. Right now in this state, water has always been an issue, and the taking of water. And you bring up that since 1850, Californians built more than 1,200 dams, one or more for every river. And at the same time, we see, beavers that could be creating viable wetlands and better habitats. We're not going that direction, though there is a movement to remove a lot of dams. So water in California, since the arrival of white people, has changed our landscape. And that's something you are grappling with there.
Yes, it's definitely impossible to live in California, especially to live in a place that is a source of water for elsewhere and not think a lot about water and be very aware of how important the handling of that is going to be going forward.
I want you to talk about Mary Austin as well. She's somebody who lived in Independence, and talk a little bit about her and her life there.
So Mary Austin came to the Eastern Sierra with her husband when she was a relatively young woman, and she really struggled to fit in anywhere. And I think in some ways she found the Eastern Sierra a place where she could fit in because she didn't have to necessarily join the human community as much. You can tell when you read her seminal work, Land of Little Rain, which was published in 1903 and written while she was living in this valley. She spent a lot of time outdoors. She spent a lot of time getting to know the native folks as well. And she sort of was a little bit of an outsider in the community that she was technically a part of. And I think because of that, she had a really interesting perspective. She listened to the people who were here first, who were and are still here, and who had learned a lot about how to live reciprocally with the landscape. And so I think she's quite ahead of her time as far as what was being published in terms of environmental writing when she was living. So her book Land of Little Rain really has a place sensibility that I find singular, even for things that I've read more contemporary literature. So she was, but she was also, she struggled. She was kicked out of the Methodist church here in the Valley because she was reading scripture more closely than she was supposed to without the permission of the pastor. In my book, I have a series of quotes that local women had to say about her that I found in local archives, all of which implied that she was a bit weird and they had a little bit of trouble understanding her. Meanwhile, she was a great writer and a great thinker. So combining her voice with my own growing understanding of my home and California and the West at large was really interesting in the book and also really helped me learn while I was writing.
And that book, again, is Land of Little Rain, Mary Austin, somebody who perhaps some of our listeners are unfamiliar with. Another thing that is large in the book is weather. You talk about it in stark and frighteningly beautiful terms. And you talk about geography. And as you said, your father, James Attlee, provides maps to hikers and travelers. And you talk about fire. And these things are all what have shaped your life living there too. So talk about your experience living in that environment and perhaps what you discovered writing the book, especially in your descriptions of the weather and the, is it the Sierra wave? That is a phenomena of weather happening in the Eastern Sierra there. So talk a little bit about all that.
Yeah. So my dad was a pilot. So a hot air balloon pilot, and he knew also he had his pilot's license for flying planes as well. So I knew a lot about, I grew up hearing a lot about weather phenomenon, and it's impossible to live in, I feel like, the West, and especially here in the Eastern Sierra, without being very aware of what's going on with the weather. Even now, just a few weeks ago, every few weeks, I feel like I'll be in my house and all of a sudden it will be what feels like a hurricane going on outside and a tree branch will fall down and then it will just stop. So we get pretty intense winds because we get the prevailing winds coming off the Pacific Ocean. They will just come roaring over the mountains and they'll create what's essentially a horizontal tornado over crashing over the mountain ranges. And sometimes it hits us on the valley floor, but often it just stays windy up high. And as a pilot, my dad had experience accidentally flying in this and learning not to fly in this. And in fact, in Owens Valley in the 50s, glider pilots did a lot of experiments in this wind phenomenon and set records, and their gliders got torn up and they got spit out and landed in their parachutes. And I go into that in the book. But my dad gave us a sense of the sublime, in the sense that we really grew up knowing that our landscape was a lot more powerful than we were, and that if we wanted to survive, we needed to respect that. It was almost a stand-in for religion in my household.
Wow. Wow. And so in some ways, this must have made you a little fearless, though it seems like you were also prepared by your parents to face dangerous situations. And maybe you want to talk about that. Your dad had kind of a unique way of helping you be maybe fearless and independent.
Yeah, I guess you could call it fearless. It was, in a way, it was being very aware of everything that could go wrong and everything that could be dangerous, and being very aware of what precautions you needed to take. So I guess that with that comes a sense of confidence. We to this day do something called filing a flight plan, where when one of us is, and I go into this in the book, where my dad would say, okay, he'll text you, I'm filing flight plan, mountain bike up this canyon back by 7. And then, you know, if he doesn't tell you closing flight plan by 7, that you need to check on him and perhaps go looking for him. And so in that sense, if you take precautions, you are a lot freer in what you can do, and you don't have to be as afraid. But at the same time, we were very aware. I think there's a Wallace Stegner quote. I always knew that I was a target, and I always knew what had me in my sights. I'm probably getting that wrong, but it's something along those lines. When he was growing up on the plains, he always knew that he was a lot less powerful than his landscape. And he had to keep that hierarchy in mind if he wanted to survive. So it was very much, it's very much that that sense of care being a way to stay alive. And in my book, I sort of extrapolate from that and I sort of apply that to the community at large. So if you've got an imperiled community or an imperiled family, you know, how are you going to apply care and attention to sort of get yourselves through the difficult times?
And is that something that writing the book helped you articulate to yourself about getting through those difficult times?
I think so. I think in deciding to come home, so the book actually opens with a freak winter wildfire, not seeming so freakish anymore. But in 2015, this was felt quite surprising. And it was a winter wildfire that burned a third of the houses in my childhood neighborhood up on the mountainside overlooking the valley here. Normally, we would have been under several feet of snow up there on the mountain. So yeah. I knew I was coming home to a place that was challenging to live. And I wanted to come home anyways. And I wanted to kind of dig in and ride out whatever was in store with that community and with my family in this place.
While you were just in grade school, you read Beryl Markham's West with the Night. And I think that this probably lighted your imagination somewhat. But throughout the book, as you mentioned, I mean, you just brought up Wallace Stegner, and you've incorporated a lot of other literary influences, Joan Didion and Rebecca Solnit, for instance. And I think that that's going to be something that readers of these people are going to immediately associate with. So you have obviously been a reader your whole life too, I would imagine.
Yes, definitely. I think that's as important. And that is the reason I am a writer. We couldn't be a writer without being a reader.
It's good to encounter these people in your book.
Oh, I really enjoyed bringing in voices of other writers, and it sort of helped me look at my home place through a lens of history instead of only through a lens of my own experience. Reading writers like Richard Rodriguez, who grew up in the Central Valley and had a lot of interesting essays about the relationship between California and Mexico, the relationship between California and the rest of the country, all those writers really helped me get it just more of a zoomed out understanding of where I came from. And that was essential to moving home, because otherwise I would have just been moving home to a place that held a lot of difficult memories. But because I sort of learned to see it in a bigger context, I was able to come back to it, I think.
How do you hope others who come to this place will experience it?
Well, I've been lucky to hear from lots of people since the book came out who don't live here, but who have a lifelong bond to the Eastern Sierra. And I'm so happy about that, because I think it's a really special place. And it's really great when people who visit don't just see it as a vacation destination, but see it as a community with a complex history and complex identity. And it really becomes a part of them, and they take it with them wherever they go. And I also am really interested to hear from folks who have similar relationships to wherever they're from, and who think about home, who are really aware of the impact their homes have on them. So I hope visiting here, if people learn about it, that'll help them reflect on their own homes as well.
And I wonder what you're working on, and if you're working on something that we might see in the future.
I've been mostly writing shorter pieces at the moment. I have an op-ed in the Washington Post about my grief at my friends who are having to leave California because of a combination of housing prices and fire threat. So I've been writing sort of shorter things, sort of responding to the changes that we've been seeing in the last few years to our fire ecology. But I'm also working on another book, and probably it's going to be fiction, and probably it's going to be very different. So stay tuned.
Okay. Well, it is something I think here in California, the extended fires season that have put many of us in a state of almost perpetual fear. yet you've come back to a place that does have a at times a harsh environment, a harsh beauty. In fact, one time in the book, you did even say something like, a burning mountain can be beautiful. And I think when you're talking right now about people who are leaving the state for one reason or another, some of these are reasons to stay as well. And I wonder what you think about that.
Yeah, there's a Robinson Jeffers line. He's a poet who lived on the central coast of California and was writing in the 20s that says, beautiful country, burn again. And I don't think he had any idea how resonant that line was going to become. And for me, the reason to stay is that I can't live anywhere else because I'm too homesick. So I'm not going anywhere. So I think for a lot of people, that's the reason to stay. This is where their family is. This is where their life is. They can't leave. And then, so at that point, what are we going to do? How are we going to take care of our homes and our communities and facing what we're facing? But I also understand that for a lot of people, there's a really intense sadness because they don't want to leave. They want to stay. They want to take care of the place, but they can't, either because they can't afford to live here, or sort of the double whammy of, yeah, they can't afford to live here. They can't afford to stay where they grew up. And also they can't handle evacuating multiple times in a month. They can't handle living with the fear of fire, which that's a very understandable thing. So I think it's really sad when people are forced to leave behind the places that they really care about. And I'm lucky not to be in that position, but I do understand those that do. And those of us that stay definitely have our work cut out for us.
Thanks so much for talking to us today, Kendra. And thank you so much for such a lovely book.
Oh, well, thanks for talking to me about it. Thanks for sharing it with your listeners.
The book is Miracle Country, a memoir of a family and a landscape, and its award-winning author is Kendra Attleywork. I am Suzanne Lang, and I bring you A Novel Idea on KRCB, Sonoma County's NPR station. Let's take a short break and then listen to my conversation with another award-winning author with her first novel set in 1960s and 70s Bombay and the world of Kathak, an ancient Indian form of dance. Stay with us. Archer is Shruti Swami's debut novel, which follows on her award-winning short story collection, A House is a Body. The book was as mesmerizing to read as the Indian traditional dance of Kathak holds the gaze. The story is of Vidya, a dancer, and her own becoming of who she is. Shruti's descriptions of Vidya's dancing are themselves ecstatic. Let's listen to our conversation. Shruti Swami, welcome to talk to me today about your book, The Archer.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Susie.
The book is set not quite in an amorphous time frame, but it is the 60s. Perhaps we know this because you call the city Bombay, and there are a few musical references that kind of put us in a time frame there. So that's the time frame and setting of the book. But before we really get into the story, the main character of the book, Vidya, is a dancer. and becomes very interested in dance and perfecting this form of dance that is known as Kathak, the traditional Indian form, or one of the traditional Indian forms of dancing, which is a key element of the story, and having this dancing world around her or in her. So talk a little bit, maybe describe for our listeners what the importance of that particular form of dance in the culture is.
The role that Kathak dance takes in Vidya's life is a completely unexpected one, and a completely the path that she's trying to make as she's drawn towards a life of an artist is not the path that anybody was expecting for her. I think that many Vidya at the beginning of the book, her family is not very well off. They're struggling to make ends meet, and as the story goes on, I think that they start to kind of, they've clawed themselves into the middle class. And this is kind of many, you know, both in that time period and here, actually here in America, many Indian American girls also will study dance. These traditions, there's many Indian classical dance forms, and all of them are so beautiful and rich with this cultural meaning and heritage. So I think it's fairly common for young women to study Indian classical dance forms and Indian classical musical traditions, but it's not nearly as common for them to decide to make their whole life out of it. It's kind of like a nice accomplishment, and it can be a really beautiful entry into Indian philosophy, Indian aesthetics, and those kinds of things. But very few, and especially maybe very few of their parents would expect them to follow that as their whole life, as the like reason, the organizing principle for their life. So in that way, Vidya, in her obsession with Kathak, is definitely unusual.
It was something for her to galvanize her heart and mind around. And I wonder if you could also talk a little bit about the story of the archer, which is mentioned in the book, maybe not even a whole bunch of times, but once it is mentioned early in the book, it's something that stays with us throughout as we see how her life progresses. And I wonder if you could just share for our listeners in a nutshell what that fable of the archer is.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that I will just sort of summarize it. It's a very complicated story. It's a story that I heard as a child and thought about for my whole life, because it's such a complicated story. And the moral that it seems to have on its face is not exactly the moral that a person who's listening to the story would necessarily take from listening to it. So the archer, the title comes from the story about Eklavya, who's a person who is clearly born to be an archer. That's his destiny and his calling, and he's extremely gifted. And he is prevented by following the mandates of his time and place. He is prevented from fulfilling his calling as an archer. And it's very brutal how that happens in the story. And I wanted to make sense of that. I've just spent a lot of time thinking about that and how it feels on its face very unfair that he's prevented. He's clearly very gifted. And the way he's prevented is very brutal. So I wanted to see what meaning could come from that unfairness and that brutality.
Yes. And it is with us, even though not on the surface, that story is with us throughout. And it is a story of family and mothers and sacrifice, and with mm-hmm. issues of culture and language and gender and notions of success and personal fulfillment. And so I wonder if you could talk about some of these themes and threads in the story and maybe set the story up a little bit for us that way.
Sure. So at the very beginning of the story, Vidya, she's a child and she's reunited with her mother and her baby brother. And the effects of that separation and that subsequent reunion are one of the main threads of the novel. It was something, one of the things I was really interested in exploring was if you come from a family that feels fractured, if your early life, you don't have the kind of parents that you need in order to create a sense of self, you can feel really marked by that. And one of the questions this book asks is, okay, if you can, you can't outrun your past, but can you still live a good whole life? Can you be a good, can you be a, you know, in relationship with other people kindly and generously? Can you make a sense of wholeness in your own life when you come from such a fractured place? So it wound up being that Vidya herself finds a sense of not just ecstatic transcendence through the exploration of Kathak, but also actually a real sense of self. The way that she sees, is able to come into herself as like a protagonist in her own life, as somebody who has agency, is through this, the study and performance of this dance form. So in that way, it is also very much a book about a young woman's artistic life and her coming into herself as an artist. You know, this book takes place, as you pointed out, in 60s and 70s era Bombay. So it concerns a culture that's fairly different from the one that I'm, a time and place than the one that I'm living in right now. But I found that some of the questions that I was really grappling with as a young woman coming of age, wanting to be an artist, and thinking about what my role was in society, how I would make a life of art, a good life, not just a life where I had to sacrifice everything for my art, and I wasn't also a good friend or a good daughter or a good partner or maybe a good mother, that I wanted to understand if somebody could make a life of art, but still, but it being a good life, a rich life, a fulfilling life. And though this book takes place in a different time and place than this one, it really does wound up really exploring these concerns that are really immediate to me as a person in this culture.
Yes. And the voice of Vidya, we hear her thoughts, her interior life as she's growing and emerging as a person, literally from when she's a toddler almost to being a grown woman. And through the course of the story, we experience her having experiences, getting older. But throughout, there's also this injection of the more mature Vidya that is also recollecting a story. And so I thought that was just a very interesting architecture to the voice of Vidya. So talk a little bit about creating that voice for her.
There are two very distinct voices in the book, although they are both Vidya's voice. And absolutely what you're saying is so true, that there is a voice. I was really thinking about when Vidya's a child, I was really thinking about the ways that we make memories and the ways that we experience, or at least the ways that I could think of that I experienced my own childhood in memory. And there's a way that some things feel really distant, like almost a sense of self to me feels really distant. And what is really, and a sense of narrative is also really distant. There's like all these machinations that are happening in the adult world that you don't necessarily, aren't necessarily privy to. And also I think when you're starting to form memories, it's, you know, how you form yourself must be having a coherent strand of memories to be like, oh, I was like this in this case, and then this thing happened, and so I was like this. And when you're so small and you're just starting to form memories, that sense of self is also a little bit incoherent. And what's very coherent, what's very immediate, is the senses, sense memory. I mean, feelings and sensations and sensual, yes. The sensual world is so present. So I was really interested, especially, I mean, I think this is especially true maybe of people who have experienced trauma, but even not, that there's a real sense of remove and a real sense of immediacy. And that was something I was really trying to capture in Vidya's voice in the earlier sections. And as she grew older, I know there is sort of a retrospective. It's, you know, it's so nice. The audiobook is narrated by this incredibly talented voice actor named Sneha Mathan. And I just was listening to it. She sent me a sample when she was working on it. And her voice is just, it really transformed the text for me. It was so wise. Her voice is so complex and rich and eyes, and it felt so right to hear her narrating Vidya, because I think there is that retrospective knowledge and that retrospective gaze that she does have in her in the later sections. And of course the sentence structure is yes. different, you know, even like the diction is different, the way that she's forming thoughts is different, because she's a more complex thinker, she's starting to make narrative connections, you know, she has a very strong sense of self now and a very strong drive, so all of those things inflected it. Thank you for that question, that's so lovely.
Vidya has an open heart and an open mind and a selfish part of her too. Sometimes yeah. she could be cruel, and she admits mm-hmm. to having a dark side, but yet she doesn't seem to judge herself harshly, and she moves on and just has a determination. She's doesn't always follow what people are, as you suggested earlier, the path to get somewhere, and dancing is a challenging way to go. But she has a determination that keeps her going. And I found that duality in her. Well, I suppose we all have a sort of duality, but I found her talking about her own duality kind of interesting. And I think she might have even called herself her dark side or her dark place or something like that.
That's a really lovely observation. And I think that's her desires are often pointed in exactly the opposite directions. And she wants both things at the same time. She finds herself always longing for connection and community and love and attention and approval and intimacy. And, you know, in many different contexts throughout this book, when she is right at the cusp of achieving what she wants in many different circumstances, something holds her back, or something about achieving that desire, actually being seen, actually being known, actually being part of something, it terrifies her or disgusts her or makes her feel really uncomfortable. You know, it's not that these desires cancel each other out in life often. You know, you can really, really want to be a mother and really not want to be a mother at the very same time. And both of those things, you know, it's not like, oh, then I just have a neutral feeling. It's like, no, I want both of them equally and horribly and painfully. So a lot of this book is Vidya kind of grappling with, you know, and part of that is the legacy of her own upbringing and her trauma. And some of it's just human nature to want exactly the opposite things at the same time. And that was something that I was really, I think I was drawn to writing about also.
Yeah, she has this defiance in her quest for expression and in her quest for relationship that she really pushes against things and is determined to go a certain direction. And then something changes within her. And then as we get that other kind of more mature voice of Vidya occasionally giving us a different perspective, it just pulls us. It's like a narrative thread that pulls the reader along. And I really felt like in watching some of the dancers who perform this kind of dancing, there's a similar sort of trajectory to their own storytelling and their dance and through their bodies. And I thought maybe that's why you had her pursuing dance, especially this kind of dance is such a, it's all about storytelling.
Yeah. And also as you were talking, I was thinking just tension, that there's so much, I mean, there's so many dualities in Kathak. There's the absolute incredible formal constraints that you have and the utter discipline that you have to have over your whole body in order to do things that make you seem absolutely light and free. You know, there's like an ease and a lightness that comes when you're when a master is dancing Kathak within that really intense, almost rigidly intense constraints of the form. Yeah, it's true that Kathak is a very narrative art form, although it's also, I think it was a little bit like unconventional, maybe many of the things that drew me to Kathak and what I wound up depicting in my book was actually the non-narrative elements. That the narrative elements are so beautiful and, you know, and so rich. The non-narrative elements are astonishing to me and I think do something that language can't do and narrative can't do. Like there's something that when you as a body are watching those abstracted movements, there's something you just immediately understand outside of cultural context. You don't need to know anything about the stories, or you don't need to know about what all these beautiful gestures, the mudras, the gestures mean. That's a whole language of just gestures, you know, with the narrative parts. Something so immediate about watching a dancer and doing these movements that you feel intuitively, you can feel it resonating in your own body. And to me, I think I was always, I love language. Language is, as Ursula Le Guin, you know, wrote her, one of her books is called Words Are My Matter. Like she compares it to a potter's, you know, potter uses clay and words are her matter. So words are my matter for better and for worse. You know, I love language. I love swimming in language and shaping it, but there's something that dancers have access to that I, as a writer, absolutely don't have, which is that incredible immediacy that bypasses language completely. That is just something that, you know, it's a visual thing, but it's not just visual. It enters the body. The body understands how a body understands how another body moves just by dint of having, you know, being in a human body. So I think that element was something I was really drawn to when I was writing.
And it really is what draws her, that physical sensation of moving and being elevated beyond her own story, even to be able to express herself. But she didn't always follow the rules, you know.
Yeah.
And this might lead us right into talking, because we really do only have a few minutes left, but I think it's really worth talking about. There are men in the book and her father and her brother and more, but it's her relationships with women in the book that are challenging to her and confounding to her and confusing to her. And her mother, who was such a loving but absent person that Vidya could never understand, maybe that loss. And then she has these teachers of dance who embrace her in a different sort of way. And she has a friend in school that is something that she also is very internally defiant at a certain point about. So I'd love you to talk about the women that she relates to as surrogate mothers and in fact, her own mother.
Well, yeah, thank you so much for that phrase, surrogate mothers, and just the attention to that in that question, Susie, because I did notice a lot of times I was trying to offer her some grace. You know, I was so devastated. I was devastated by what happens to her early in the book and her lack of mothering. And so there were many opportunities that I wanted to give her, extend her moments of community, and especially, and actually specifically mothering, that she is sometimes looking for mothers, or is sometimes just offered, even she's not even, you know, looking for them, but is offered these moments of women and maybe sometimes a community of women looking out for her, noticing her, you know, encouraging her, that felt really important to me. This isn't answering your question. I'm saying something a little different, but this is a book that deals with a lot of really difficult subjects. And yet to me, it's actually a happy book. You know, I was asking a question, how do people survive? I mean, often my work is about how do people survive this, and not just survive like I'm going to keep living another day, but I'm going to, you know, I'm not going to be fully in my day. I'm not invested in my life anymore. How do people survive and live deeply still and joyfully with so much sorrow and trauma and all these difficult things that happen to people all the time? So this book was was one answer to that question. And I ultimately, this is a book about like the true like joy and privilege of being alive and how beautiful the world is. I mean, that maybe that sounds sort of cheesy. I think it's less cheesy in the book than how I just said it.
It's much less cheesy in the book, but I think that, you know, what you're telling us right now is, in fact, isn't that really what each of our lives, very few of us get out without loss, without hurt, you know, without disappointment. And when that gets layered on, how do you ever rise above that? And it is possible to do so. I think it is a hopeful book. And I felt like I was in this mist of a story. There was a lightness about it that pulled me with it. So I think it was a really successful way that you approached the storytelling. And did you grow up in India?
I grew up in the U.S. I was born here, but my parents both grew up in India in the 60s and 70s in Bombay. So that was one of the reasons I was drawn to writing about that place and time. It felt like a world that was kind of in some ways mythical because it's gone now. You know, the city that now exists, that's now called Mumbai, is just a completely different city than this one that I was hearing about throughout my childhood and seeing pictures of and hearing stories about. So part of the earliest impulses to write this book was to just inhabit this world that I had these images that had fed my imagination for so many years. And it was one of, honestly, the foremost pleasures of writing this book was being able to spend time in that world, which is not like to the letter, probably factually accurate world. I wanted to get the details right as much as I could, but I more wanted to get a feeling of what it might have felt like for a person like Vidya, not, the definitive, depiction of a city, but a person like Vidya, how they might have experienced the city then.
Just lastly, I wonder when you're writing and you're setting the book someplace else where they speak a different language and you filter in certain words and how do you create that balance for yourself, but also anticipating what a reader might react to? Is that something you put a lot of thought into?
Oh yeah, thank you for that question. I really thought about it a lot. Actually, nobody's asked me that. And it's something I really, many of the decisions I made were intuitive. But of course, I went back a lot and just means tested all the decisions I made because I wanted to make sure the things I was balancing was that I wanted to give enough of the flavor of the language. There's certain words that you just can't translate and just have a musical quality to them that seems so beautiful that I wanted to have the like taste of that language. But I also wanted words to feel like, there's some, like she calls her dad, father, sir, or respected teacher. Sometimes she addresses her teacher as respected teacher. And these are, this is a kind of way of trying to get a formality in English that we wouldn't necessarily use. I wanted something that felt distinct from the way that we might address people in American culture right now, that was not so jarring that it would be too distracting, but that just gave you a certain, the way that Hindi is structured, for example, like you don't really say thank you because you can be like the most polite you can ever be is in Hindi. Hindi is this exquisitely polite language that is, there's so many ways that you are respecting the person that you are talking to if you feel respect towards them. There's so many ways that you give that person respect just through the way that what address you use, the ways that the verbs are conjugated. So I wanted to get that language has a perspective that's different than our perspective, English perspective. So I wanted to get the aesthetic or the perspective without ever feeling like it was jarring or flashy or something, because that's not how Vidya experienced it. There's some things that I don't translate. And there's some cultural stuff that I don't explain. And I never wanted, because that can be jarring the other way. If I came and stepped out and said, you know, bhel puri, a delicious street side snack, you know, whatever. That's not how Vidya experiences bhel puri, you know. So I wanted to be also true to her perspective and what would feel natural to her. So all of those things, and doing it in a language, you know, if Vidya actually was telling her story, the story would be in Gujarati. It would not even be in English. So again, in one way, I was using language to write about Kathak in a way that to do something with language that I wasn't actually, you know, I was like longing to write about dance so that I could bypass these like limitations of language. And then another way, I'm using language here again to do something English, to do something it's not supposed to be doing. So I had to make some compromises also.
Yeah. Very good. Shruti Swami, what a joy to talk to you today. The book is The Archer. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Susie. This was really lovely.
Shruti Swami and her book is The Archer. Earlier, I spoke with Kendra Attlee-Work, and her book is Miracle Country, a memoir of a family and a landscape. The music today has been flautist Jeannie Backstresser with Two Bits, composed by Henry Cowell, and Under Pressure by David Bowie and Queen. And we're going out with some Kathak music from Hassam Ramzi and Rafael Taquel. I am Suzanne Lang, and I thank both my guests along with James Morey and Mark Brell for production assistance. I am here the first and fifth Sunday of the month, streaming and podcasting at krcb.org, where you can listen to past shows and subscribe. This is a production of Lit Radio and Northern California Public Media. We love to hear from you. Drop a note to listener@krcb.org. Thank you for listening. It's a novel idea. Tita did the day, 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 Tita did the day